The 1980s was not the best time to live in California. The world was changing, drugs were raging, and a crazed serial killer was on the loose. I'm Felicia Huffman, and this is Macabre at Midnight. Welcome back. Mom's with us again.
Hello.
The last two times you were with us, mm-hmm. we were talking about haunted places.
Of course.
This week, we won't be.
Okay.
We'll be talking about murder. Okay. Serial killer.
Okay.
A gross one at that. I mean, not that any serial killers were nice. But.
I mean, if you think about, you know, Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer. They were not nice.
No.
They were very gross.
Yeah. Especially Dahmer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Jack the Ripper. Yeah. Just an interview.
We're just name dropping here.
Yeah.
So, I will begin. I don't really, unless you have something you want to share with everybody, I'll just jump into my trigger warning.
I don't reckon I have anything I need to share. I ain't pregnant or nothing. So.
That would be a miracle if you were, considering.
Yeah, I know that ripped out a couple years ago.
You're missing a very important component to get pregnant. But yeah, so please be warned, this our subject matter is disturbing. I always forget the word disturbing when I'm doing a trigger warning. Richard Ramirez, or as he was better known, the Night Stalker, left Los Angeles paralyzed by fear in the mid-1980s. Before his reign of terror was brought to an end, he had killed at least 14 people and tortured several others. The life and terror of Richard Ramirez will be done in two parts. This week, we will talk about his childhood and the majority of his crimes. Next week, we will go into the investigation, trial, death, and more.
Okay.
Ramirez was born on February 29, 1960 in El Paso, Texas. He was the fifth and youngest child of Mexican immigrants Mercedes and Julian Ramirez. His four siblings were Robert, Ruth, Joseph, and Reuben. Poor Joseph, he's the only one without an R name.
Yeah.
Richard had a rather troubled childhood in Texas. Ramirez sustained several head injuries during his early years. At the age of five, he was knocked unconscious by a swing. After that, he started to experience epileptic seizures. Julian, Richard's father, worked for the railway and had been a policeman in Mexico. He was also prone to fits of anger that resulted in physical abuse. In his early teen years, Ramirez was strongly influenced by his older cousin, Miguel. Miguel had recently returned from the Vietnam War and was a decorated Green Beret. He was most likely the one who introduced Richard to drugs, as the two would smoke marijuana together, as Miguel would tell Richard about the torture and mutilation he had inflicted on Vietnamese women. He would back up these stories with photos. In some of the photos, Miguel posed with the severed head of a woman he had abused. He would even teach Richard some of his military skills, such as killing with stealth. It was around this time that Richard started to sleep in a local cemetery in order to avoid his father's violent temper.
I'm sorry, I could find some other place in a local cemetery to sleep, to stay away from my daddy. I mean, I don't know if they, I'm sure they had them. A park bench would have been better. I'm sorry.
Yeah. On May 4th, 1973, Richard was present when his cousin Miguel fatally shot his wife, Jessie, in the face with a .38 caliber revolver during a domestic argument. After this, Richard became withdrawn and sullen from his family and peers. Later that same year, Richard moved in with his sister Ruth and her husband Roberto. Roberto was an obsessive peeping Tom, who often took Richard along on his nightly escapades. This was also the time when Richard began using LSD. Miguel would eventually be found not guilty of Jesse's murder by reason of insanity and was released in 1977 after being incarcerated at the Texas State Mental Hospital. He continued to influence Richard.
Found not guilty by reason of insanity.
Yeah.
For shooting and killing his wife in the face.
Yeah.
Was he insane?
Well, he had been in the Vietnam War, so...
Oh, that was the one that... Miguel, okay.
Yeah.
That, okay. Well, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, the war had affected him greatly. Okay. Unfortunately, unfortunately, he helped push that on to Richard as well, plus the fact that Richard's father was crap. But I'll get into that in the second one.
Well, I mean, I could stop talking about my Uncle Larry, but we won't go into that because then we won't get it's finished. So go ahead.
The adolescent Ramirez started to meld his newfound sexual fantasies with violence, including forced bondage and rape. While he was in school, he took a job at a Holiday Inn where he would use his pass key to rob people. He was fired after he tried to rape a woman in her hotel room before her husband returned to find them. The husband ended up beating Ramirez senseless, but they dropped the charges against him because they didn't want to return to testify against him.
Yeah.
Richard never graduated high school, dropping out in ninth grade. Richard was arrested for the first time in 1977 for possession of marijuana. Then at the age of 22, he moved to California. In California, his addiction to cocaine grew, as did his burglaries. He also started to cultivate an interest in Satanism. While in Los Angeles, he was arrested for auto theft twice, once in 1981, and then again in 1984. Around this time, he had also started to neglect his personal hygiene.
Yeah.
Not much else is known about Richard's childhood, but it is believed that his experiences are what caused him to become a sociopath. Richard had the ability to feel emotions. In fact, that's what drove his crimes. People often refer to a sociopath as a hothead. They tend to act without thinking about what it could do to others. We all have a tendency to do that, but sociopaths take it too far. Psychopaths, on the other hand, have no connection to emotions. They are cold-hearted and calculating. Psychopaths need control and will plan out their crimes, much like John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy. Richard didn't do that. Richard acted on impulse. He attacked at random. While his crimes did start taking on a similar process, he didn't plan out who he was going to kill or how everything was going to happen. His first crime, which was not connected to him until 2009 after DNA matched him to the crime scene, took place on April 10, 1984. Ramirez murdered 9-year-old Chinese-American Mei Ling in the basement of the hotel where he was living. He beat and raped the girl before stabbing her to death and hanging her body from a pipe.
Good Lord.
In 2016, officials announced that there was evidence of a second suspect, identified through DNA sample retrieved from the scene, who is believed to have been present when Ling was murdered. Authorities have not publicly identified the suspect and said that the person had been a juvenile at the time. It was the murder of Jenny Vincow on June 28, 1984, that had long been believed to be his first murder. Jenny was found brutally murdered in her apartment in Glassell Park, Los Angeles. He had stabbed her repeatedly as she slept in her bed, and her throat was slashed so deeply that she was nearly decapitated. They found Ramirez's fingerprint on the mesh screen he moved to gain access through an open window. It would be a long time before Ramirez attacked again. It seemed as though he was able to keep his urges under control for nearly a year. But he eventually couldn't control those urges anymore. His murder spree officially started March 17, 1985. 22-year-old Maria Hernandez was attacked outside of her home in Rosemead, California. She was shot in the face with a .22 caliber handgun after she pulled into her garage. Luckily, the bullet ricocheted off of her keys that she had in her hand as she raised her arms to protect herself. While she was able to survive, her roommate was not so lucky. Del Yoshi Akazaki, age 34, heard the gunshot from outside the house and ducked behind a counter when she saw Ramirez walk into the kitchen. When Del finally raised her head to see if Ramirez was there, he shot her once in the forehead, killing her. Ramirez wasn't finished for the night, though. Within just an hour of the Rosemead home invasion, Ramirez pulled 30-year-old Cy Lane Veronica Yu out of her car in Monterey Park. He then shot her twice with a .22 caliber handgun and fled the scene. She was pronounced dead upon arrival at the hospital. Two murders and an attempted murder all in one day attracted quite a bit of news coverage. Thanks to Maria, they also had a description of the attacker. The media said he had curly hair, bulging eyes, and wide-spaced rotting teeth. They dubbed him the Valley Intruder and the Walk-In Killer. After only 10 days, on March 27th, Ramirez struck again. He entered a home that he had burglarized a year earlier just outside of Whittier at around 2 in the morning and killed the sleeping Vincent Charles Zazara at age 64. He was shot in the head with 22. Maxine, Vincent's wife, aged 44, was awakened by the gunshot. Ramirez beat her and bound her hands as he demanded to know where her valuables were. While he ransacked the home, Maxine was able to get out of her bonds and got a shotgun from under the bed, but it wasn't loaded. This made Richard angry, and he shot her 3 times with the 22. He then got a large carving knife and mutilated her body by stabbing her several times, gouging out her eyes, and placing them in a jewelry box, and then left with the jewelry box.
Good Lord.
The autopsy found that the mutilations had happened after she had been killed. The couple's son, Peter, found their bodies. Ramirez left behind footprints from his Avia sneakers in the flower bed, which turned out to be one of the best leads the police had. The bullets found at the scene were matched to those found at the other attacks. A little over a month later, on May 14th, Ramirez returned to Monterey Park and entered the home of Bill Doy, 66, and Lillian, 54. Ramirez surprised Doy in his bedroom and shot him in the face with his .22 semi-automatic pistol as Doy reached for his own gun. After beating the mortally wounded man unconscious, Ramirez entered Lillian's room. He bound her with thumb cuffs and then raped her after he ransacked the house looking for valuables. Bill died later at the hospital from his wounds.
Okay. You know he got the shooting him in the face from Miguel, because that's how Miguel killed his wife.
Yeah.
Just interjecting there.
Yeah. On May 29th, Richard drove a stolen car to Monrovia and stopped at 83-year-old Mabel Bell's house that she shared with her sister Florence Lang, 81. He found a hammer in the kitchen. He bound Lang in her bedroom and bludgeoned her with the hammer. He then did the same to Bell. He then took an electrical cord and shocked Bell. After he raped Lang, he used Bell's lipstick to draw a pentagram symbol on her thigh and on the walls of the bedrooms. They were found 2 days later, alive but comatose. Bell would later die from her injuries. The next day, Ramirez drove to Burbank in the same car and snuck into the home of Carol Kyle, 42. At gunpoint, he bound Kyle and her 11-year-old son with handcuffs, then he ransacked the house. He released Kyle momentarily so that she could show him where their valuables were, and then he raped her repeatedly. Ramirez repeatedly told her not to look at him, saying that he would cut her eyes out. He left after he took the child out of the closet and bound the two together again. After just over a month, on July 2nd, he took a stolen car to Arcadia and randomly chose the house of Mary Louise Cannon, 75. After he entered her home, he found her asleep. He bludgeoned her into unconsciousness using a lamp and then stabbed her with a 10-inch butcher knife. On July 5th, Ramirez broke into a house in Sierra Madres and bludgeoned 16-year-old Whitney Bennett using a tire iron as she slept. He looked for a knife, but after he couldn't find one, he tried to strangle her with his telephone cord. He later said that he was surprised to see electrical sparks come from the cord, and then when she started to breathe, he left thinking that Jesus had intervened. Bennett did survive, but required 478 stitches to close the lacerations on her scalp.
Goodness.
On July 7th, Ramirez broke into the house of Joyce Lucille Nelson, 60, in Monterey Park. She was asleep on the couch. Ramirez beat her to death using his fists and kicking her in the head. They found his Avia shoe print on her face. He cruised to other neighborhoods but returned to Monterey Park and broke into the house of 63-year-old Sophie Dickman. Ramirez handcuffed and assaulted Dickman at gunpoint, tried to rape her, and stole her jewelry. When she swore that he had taken everything of value, he told her to swear to Satan. On July 20th, Ramirez bought a machete before he drove his stolen Toyota to Glendale. There he broke into the house of Layla Needing, 66, and her husband Maxon, 68. He hacked the couple with the machete and then killed them with shots to the head with a .22 caliber handgun. He mutilated their bodies even more with the machete before he robbed them. He fenced the stolen items and then drove to Sun Valley. At around 4:15 in the morning, he broke into the Covenant's home. He shot Chinarong, who was sleeping, killing him instantly. He then beat and raped Somkid. He bound the couple's terrified 8-year-old son before he dragged Somkin around the house to show him where their valuables were. He again told her to swear to Satan that she hadn't that she wasn't hiding anything from him. On August 6th, he drove to North Ridge and broke into the home of Chris and Virginia Peterson. When he eased into the bedroom, he startled Virginia, 27, and then shot her in the face with a 25 caliber semi-automatic handgun. He then shot Chris in the neck and tried to flee. However, Chris was able to fight back while avoiding getting hit by two more shots during their struggle before Ramirez escaped. Both survived their injuries. On August 8th, Ramirez headed to Diamond Bar, California, and broke into the house of Sakina and Elias Abawath. Sometime after 2:30, he entered the master bedroom. He killed the sleeping Elias with a shot to the head. He handcuffed and beat Sakina and then forced her to reveal where the family's jewelry was. And then he brutally raped her. He told her several times to swear to Satan that she wouldn't scream during the assault. When the 3-year-old entered the bedroom, Ramirez tied the child up and continued to rape Sakina. After Ramirez left, Sakina untied her son and sent him over to the neighbors to get help. Ramirez was keeping track of the media coverage of his crimes and headed to San Francisco. On August 18th, he broke into the home of Peter and Barbara Pan. He shot Peter and then beat and raped Barbara before he shot her in the head and leaving her for dead. Before he left, Ramirez used lipstick to draw a pentagram and the phrase "Jack the Knife" on the bedroom wall. He left behind a shoe print at the scene.
He needs to get rid of them shoes.
But the police were very... Well, actually, he did at some point, but we'll get into that in the next episode. All
right.
Ramirez then headed back to Los Angeles on August 24th. That night, he went to the home of James Romero, Jr., who had just gotten back from a family vacation. Romero's son, 13-year-old James III, happened to be awake and heard Ramirez walking around outside. Believing that there was a prowler, James went to wake his parents. Ramirez fled. James ran outside and saw the color, make, and style of the car and partial plate number. Ramiro contacted the police. After that, Ramirez broke into the house of Bill Carnes and his fiancée Inez Erickson. He entered their bedroom, and when he cocked his gun, he awakened Carnes. He shot him 3 times in the head before turning his attention to Erickson. Ramirez told her he was the Night Stalker and made her swear that she loved Satan as he beat her and bound her with neckties. After he stole whatever he could find, Ramirez dragged Erickson to a different room before he raped her. He demanded more cash and jewelry and told her to swear to Satan that there was no more. Before he left, Ramirez told her, quote, "Tell them the Night Stalker was here." She untied herself and went to the neighbors to get help. Carnes survived his injuries. That brings us to the end of Ramirez's known killings. While he was only really active between April and August of 1985, he left his mark on Los Angeles.
Wow, he was busy.
Yep.
Did he ever sleep? I guess he slept during the day since he'd done all that at night. He would...
And, you know, cocaine people, they got energy for days.
Yeah. I don't really know what to say. I mean, how many people was that he killed in just 4 months' time? I lost count.
In just the 4 months, I'm not sure, but I'm in total, I'm pretty sure he got charged for 14 murders. And that's just going about his murders. There was also kidnappings he did during that, but most people don't report on that because the police dropped those charges. We'll touch on that in the second episode. It's actually kind of a good reason. And if anybody's watched the Netflix special on him, they'll know the reason why they dropped the kiddie charges. But he's likely the cause of the whole Satanist fear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he perverted the pentagram.
Yeah, come to think about it, because I graduated in 86, and my senior year was when all that satanic stuff blew up in school.
Yep.
Where people claimed they kept seeing a guy walking around behind the school in a black cape with red glowing eyes. I don't know. Maybe they did. I didn't see him. Maybe I was the lucky ones. But
I think they probably just saw a random guy that meant nobody any harm because he was a bit weird. And I'm sure there was news coverage of the Night Stalker here.
If there was, I don't remember it, but there probably was. During that time, I was probably either in my room doing my homework or reading and not paying attention. That's what I did. That's what I still do. Yeah, I kind of, I mean, I know you talked a lot about some of his the people that survived. I just, my mind goes to the one that had the over almost 500 stitches in her head.
Yep.
It's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, and when this happened, that's something I think I saw in one of the articles I read. Most everybody kept their doors unlocked or their windows open and everything at that time. And that's why he was able to just get in and get out easily. But yeah, I hadn't really thought about it until you mentioned it. But I think, well, I know his killings were inspired by his cousin's war stories.
Yeah.
The fact that his cousin raped women in Vietnam mm-hmm. and mutilated them.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he killed his wife by shooting her in the head, because that was all of Ramirez's kill shots.
Yeah.
Was in the head.
Face or head, yep.
And in the documentary about him with his, well, it wasn't technically his first murder, but the one where he shot the roommate in the driveway, she survived and then went inside. And the woman actually laid there for quite some time, trying to listen to see if he was going to leave. And as the detectives told the story, she basically, more than likely, nobody really knows what she was thinking in those last minutes, came to the realization that he wasn't going to leave and she couldn't lay there forever. And as soon as she raised her head.
Yeah. And not knowing exactly how long that was, to know that he stood there trained with his gun trained on that kitchen counter, or I think that's what you said.
It was, well, she hid behind a kitchen counter, but he didn't shoot over it. It's not, she didn't raise up above it. She just looked up from laying down, and he shot her in the forehead. That was also, he was wearing an AC/DC hat when he did that, and it was left behind at the crime scene. And I'm guessing that's at the time that AC/DC got its little nickname.
Oh, yeah. Antichrist, Death to Children.
Yeah. It's amazing how people's minds will take something as insignificant as a stupid AC/DC hat and
Christian minds, because that was what we were told in church. They had a big, I remember it was like a month long Sunday nights. The preacher would have a different person there talking about all the satanic music. You had Metallica, you had AC/DC. DC. You had Kiss.
Oh, yeah, because that's Kids in Satan's Service.
Yes. I mean, and I'm sitting there thinking, huh?
Stupid. They're musicians.
You know, I mean, and, you know, growing up, I was never allowed to listen. It was either gospel or country music. And if you really think about country music lyrics, they're just as bad. It just didn't have the loud music behind it.
Yeah, see, that's country music, same kind of message as rock music. It's just cloaked in a softer tone.
Yeah.
And it tricks the brains of the listener into thinking it's a nicer message. It's really not. They don't talk as much about drugs, but they still drink a lot. I'd say most people that were in the music business, especially when drugs were at its height in the 60s and 70s and 80s, probably did experiment with drugs. I'm not saying all of them did, but I would say no matter what genre you were in, unless maybe gospel, I don't know, maybe they did too, they probably experimented with drugs.
Yeah, I mean, especially, I mean, if anybody watched the movie Walk the Line with Joaquin Phoenix, I think that's what you pronounce his name. Which he did a crank Johnny Cash. Those people, and I don't remember who their manager was, but they put all those people on one bus and they drove them from town to town, barely stopping, letting them take a shower or pee or get something to eat, whatever. They had to do something,
mm-hmm.
you know, to keep them going. Caffeine wasn't doing it. So, hello. Yeah. Let's do this.
And most of the time, unless you're maybe Motley Crue and you just do it because you think it's cool, most of the time, from what I've heard, those who get on drugs, it's because they start getting sluggish and they can't keep up with the schedule. And somebody comes along, it's like, hey man, this'll give you a boost of energy. And that's all she wrote.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was the one that got us off on AC/DC.
Well, that's okay. But like, yeah, in the 80s, that was when the big Satan worshiping thing, I mean, and we're clean across the country, but going back, and I said earlier, I wasn't going to get off on the tangent, but we've already crossed that line, with Uncle Larry being in the Vietnam War, he You know, you've heard me tell stories of him terrorizing his family.
Yep.
Won't name any names, keeping the innocent innocent. But he, I don't know how many times he beat his wife. And I still say his music and just the way he acted is what caused Mamma to get Alzheimer's. Because he played that, his war records. And I don't know if you've ever listened to them, but they're not pleasant.
No, I was just getting ready to ask, what kind of stuff is it? Just military music, or is it the sounds of war, like gunshots? Sounds of war,
gunshots.
Who in their bombs, right mind came up with that?
I don't know. And then it would it would have like they called it Green Beret music. I don't know if he was an actual Green Beret or not.
Miguel was.
I know Miguel was. I don't remember if Larry was, but I mean, I do remember Glenda running away from home. But she actually had just snuck into the basement of their house, and she lived on canned food that they had canned. I'm pretty sure she stayed gone for a week or two.
And nobody thought to check the basement.
I guess not. They didn't need anything from it. And God knows Larry wasn't going to get off his butt to do anything.
Go ahead and say it. It's okay.
I mean, he beat his kids. He beat his wife.
He shot at his kids, didn't he?
Yeah, this was after, I don't know that Memo had died at that point, but it was after she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and my aunt took her out of that house because they were not taking care of her. They were making fun of her, because she was basically, Memo turned into his slave. She was no longer his mother. She
and their cash cow.
Yeah, and their cash cow. Because... his wife tried her best to work, but when he beat her up, there would be days when she couldn't go to work. So she lost a lot of jobs because she was having to heal, where she either couldn't walk or she didn't want people to see her face black and blue. Or I think one time he might have actually broken her arm because she wore it in like a sling. She never went to the doctor, but I mean, she powered through. That woman's strength, or I don't know whether to call her, she was strong or she was dumb. I know she stayed to try to protect the kids.
I would call her strong because, she stayed alive for the kids.
Yeah, she did. And then, like I said, I can't remember if it would have been after Mamma died when he was on a drunken rampage one weekend. It was in November. And his son knew, he saw it in his dad's eyes, and he watched him go for the gun. And he got his mom and his younger sisters, him and his older sister, him and his, the younger, the one right under him, they were just like a year or so apart. But they had three other kids that I'm pretty sure Glenda didn't want to have, that were below the age of 10 at this time. And like I said, his son saw what was getting ready to transpire, and he shoved his mom and his sisters out of the house and got them away. I actually think he just shoved them in the car and he drove them. I don't know where he drove them, but he drove them somewhere and told them to stay there until he got back. And I'm pretty sure before he was able to get out of the house, Larry shot, and he wound up with buckshot in his arm. He still got his family to safety, and then when he came back, Larry had killed himself.
Oh, that's the day that Larry killed himself.
And that was right before Thanksgiving, because I know you were a baby. I mean, you probably don't remember.
Oh, I was alive.
Yeah, that's the reason I remembered that it was after Mamma had died, because Mamma died in 88, and you were born in 92.
Chances are, had he not realized what his dad was getting ready to do,
he would have killed them all.
Larry would have killed them all and then killed himself.
Yeah.
Like the coward he was.
Yeah. Yep.
And I feel bad calling him a coward, because had he not had to go to Vietnam, he probably wouldn't have turned out that way. What kind of a person was he like before the war? Did you know him?
I didn't know him because, see, I was only born in 68. So
Was,
I only knew him after the war. And
But Vietnam did that to a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'd imagine Miguel probably wasn't that crazy and would have never imagined doing those things that he did during the war.
Yeah.
But Vietnam messed with everybody involved.
Yeah, well, I mean, we shouldn't have been there in the first place. And then, of course, when they came home,
they didn't know what PTSD was.
No. And those people that went to the Vietnam War, they weren't saluted and taken, you know, and praised like the people that came home from World War One and World War Two and Korea and all those. Vietnam War, those people that came home, they were, pardon my language, they were shit on. They weren't given the, what's the word I'm looking for? Praise is the only thing I can think of. Dignity. The respect. That's the word. They were not given the respect that they deserved because they were thrown in a situation they shouldn't have been in.
Yeah. And people were resentful for the war, so they took it out on the soldiers, even though it wasn't the soldiers' fault. Exactly. Most of them were probably drafted and didn't have a choice.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it screwed with a lot of people. And I mean, although there are people that I've known that were in the Vietnam War that it didn't affect. And it goes back to the person, how strong, I guess, they are, how, I guess, they're strong, their psyche or whatever it is to be able to withstand all that. So, good Lord, excuse me.
Well, see, I don't know that I would say that because it makes it sound like people who get PTSD are weak and they're not.
Well, no.
Because everybody probably that's went through war has some form of PTSD. It's just some learns how to deal with it or is willing to deal with it.
Yeah.
Whereas you, because I asked you if they offered Larry any help. No, and you,
they didn't. I mean, the VA didn't offer him any help. Well, of course, he was a very bad alcoholic, and that was usually when he would go on his little tangents, is when he had been drinking a lot. Don't know how many times we would go see them on Sundays, and he would be beat to a pulp, and Daddy, God rest his soul, would be like, well, who'd you piss off? And Mamaw, her little soft little voice, is like, he was in a bar fight last night, you know, and that was Mamaw's normal. That was normal for him. So, I mean, she lived that. And there were times, I mean, honestly, we walked in there one time, and I'm pretty sure it was the whole left side of his face. His eye looked like it was ready to pop out of the socket. He was so beat up and so cut up. They did try to put him on that medicine that when you take that medicine, it makes you sick. It didn't bother him. He still took it, and he still drank. I think it just messed with his head even more. But yeah, the military has, and it's not just Vietnam people. They still do it today. They recognize PTSD now, which is good, but they don't treat their soldiers.
Yeah, there's still a huge stigma around mental health, period. Whether you got your PTSD from war or from trauma you've lived through in your life, people still look at you as being weak.
Yeah.
And that's not the case, because it can happen to anybody. And those people who's like, oh, you're so weak, I about guarantee you, you've probably got some sort of PTSD or anxiety or depression. You're just not willing to admit it to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why you pick on these people, as you're projecting, because you can see that in yourself and you're afraid of it.
Yes. Absolutely.
But yes, if Richard had a better father and he didn't have to turn to Miguel, his war-crazed cousin, he might not have turned out as badly as he did.
Yeah. But he didn't bother. He just done random strangers. He didn't hurt his family, did he?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a bit of a soapbox in the second episode.
Okay. Well, I'll soapbox this one, so.
I mean, and I know there's probably people out there when I guess, make excuses for killers like Ramirez, but he was made a killer due to his upbringing. And he didn't have an emotional attachment to his parents. He didn't have good role models. He got onto drugs, and he never found that one person that could help him. Yes, what he did was wrong, and it's inexcusable, but it could have been prevented had somebody been there for him.
Mm-hmm.
But then you take the likes of John Wayne Gacy or Ted Bundy. they were psychopaths. They were likely born that way, and there's nothing that would have probably prevented it, because there's no way of helping that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think you're making excuses for him. Your empathy allows you to see things differently than others. And I agree, if he had had a better upbringing, if he had had a solid family life and had someone other than Miguel who he could have looked up to or whatever that could have led him down a different path, this might not have happened. But, you know, things happen and then shit happens. And then it gets really ugly.
So any other thoughts about the Night Stalker?
I think we've about covered all we can cover on that for now. Family stories and everything else. I think we've touched all bases.
And I'm sure we're not the only one, and they're not the only ones that has people from that went through Vietnam that's like, yep, I got similar stories.
Yeah.
Because...
I mean, I'm sure people even nowadays that's went through Afghanistan and the Gulf War and all that stuff, they're probably like, yep, I can relate.
Yep. Oh, I was going to say this on Larry, and no offense, but I don't think he would have accepted the help if there had been help available for his PTSD.
I don't think so either. I really don't. It was just not in his nature. He was, I don't know, like I said, I don't remember his upbringing, and I don't remember Daddy saying it, but, you know, he was the baby of the family, and I'm pretty sure he was kind of like my younger sister. He was catered to, and then, like I said, I'm pretty sure him and, I don't know if they got married right before he went in, or if they had been married, and then he got drafted, not sure, but... He always lived with Mamaw. He never had a home of his own. Well, I'll take that back. He did move into a trailer, probably in the early 80s, that I think was put in him, in his and his wife's name. But yet, Mamaw had to go. Mamaw, like you said, Mamaw was his lifeline. She was the breadwinner. I mean, she was in her... I can't do the math. I don't know how old she was. She was in her 60s or 70s, and she was still working at hotels, cleaning, mopping floors, making beds. Plus, she had to come home and do the same thing and cook them supper because he couldn't do anything for himself. He was always, I want to use the word coddled, because to me, that's what he was done. He and she, I honestly think they were all afraid of him. They walked around on eggshells around him because they never knew when he was going to blow up.
Yeah.
We know that feeling.
Not to that extent.
Not to that extent, no. But medicine does help. It was just, I mean... Honestly, Mama was his lifeline, and I think that's when he really went downhill, is when my aunt took Mama out of that environment when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and she moved her in with her. Of course, her kids bothered Mama too, but we won't get into that. And I honestly think that's when Larry went downhill, is he didn't have mommy to... do everything for him. And at this point, his wife was working full-time, and I'm pretty sure the job she was working at, she liked it, and she just made sure she stayed there. His two older kids were working, and the younger kids, thank God, were in school, so he couldn't, you know. But I think that was when he started going downhill, was when he didn't have Mamaw there to... And he never physically abused Mamaw. He did Glenda. He did his wife. But he never laid a hand on Mamaw. He verbally abused her, yeah. But he never beat her. I guess that's just the difference and respecting. I don't know if that you call that respect.
It's not respect to me. He still abused her. Doesn't matter if he didn't touch her.
Yeah, I guess he figured, well, she's my mom. I shouldn't beat on her, but
yeah, for some people, as long as you don't hit somebody, then you respect them. You can speak as horrible as you want to, but you're still respectful. No, it's not the case, but whatever.
But yeah, I think that's when he started going downhill worse. And then at his graveside, there's like, oh, he was saved at a very young age, so he's rejoicing in heaven. And I'm sitting there thinking, if that's in heaven, I don't want to be there. And I know that's not a very Christian attitude to have, being brought up in a strict Baptist home. But,
virgin on evangelical, if you really think about how they did things.
I remember distinctly that going through my mind at his funeral was, if he's there, I don't want to be there. And I stand by that. I mean, where I go, I go. I will take it. I don't care. But I'm sorry. And I know they say, well, you know, once saved, always saved. Again, I guess Darla asked me, my older sister asked me one time, are you a free will Baptist? Because they believe you can backslide and lose your salvation. I don't care. But we were over when they moved into the trailer. He turned on the air conditioning or something one time when Daddy was sitting on the edge of the couch or into the couch. And Larry was like, now give it a few minutes. There'll be some cold air blowing up your ass. And Mama was like, Larry, watch your language. He says, oh, I don't care to be no damn Christian. He's not claim to be no damn Christian. He said, I'll say whatever the hell I want to say. And so I'm thinking, okay. He makes remarks. He doesn't claim to be a Christian, but yeah, he was saved at a very young age and he's going to be in heaven. I'm sorry. Okay, I got off on a religious tangent. I need to mash. Sorry. But there's so much crap that's in my head. I'm sorry. I'll shut up when you wrap it up.
It's okay. I like the juxtaposition.
But anywho, yeah.
And you're probably not alone in those thoughts, because anybody who has been to a funeral or whatever of a person who they know did extremely bad things, and I'm not meaning they drank alcohol or they cussed or they watched dirty movies. Everybody does that. I'm talking about they beat people and they did bad things that they never felt sorry for. They never apologized for. And yep, the preacher or whatever is saying, he was saved, he's going to heaven. And you're sitting there going, seriously? At what point does your membership to heaven get revoked?
Exactly. What do you have to do? Go pee on the Pope?
Sorry.
I mean, are you okay?
Put that on a t-shirt. Pee on a Pope.
What did you do to get your salvation rejected? I peed on a Pope. Sorry.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Well, I think on that note, we'll wrap this up. I like that. Let's end it on peeing on a Pope. That's it for tonight. Make sure you tune in next week to hear about the investigation and capture of Richard Ramirez. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and stay spooky, everybody, and see you next time.